the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
First this morning, we speak with renowned physicist Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder, who is the creator of the popular YouTube series Science Without the Gobbledygook. She takes a no-nonsense approach to life's biggest questions and wrestles with what physics really means and says about the human condition in her new book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions.
And then cybersecurity and healthcare executives Chris Larkin, Chief Technology Officer, and Lisbeth Malig, Information Security and Privacy Officer at Concord Technologies. They will discuss security and privacy concerns and implications in a post-Roe v. Wade world, including how the data and information put into technologies like period tracker apps can be accessed and used against them if they seek abortions.
Well, what are life's biggest questions from the perspective of a physicist? We are about to find out. We're joined by the creator of the YouTube series Science Without the Gobbledygook, Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder, who joins us to discuss her new book, Existential Physics. It's a scientist's guide to life's biggest questions. Dr. Hossenfelder says that science and religion actually have the same roots, and they both tackle difficult questions about humanity's past and future. Let's explore all this with this renowned physicist, Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, good to talk to you.
Well, good morning to you, Sabine. Now, you are called a contrarian scientist. Why is that?
Oh, I guess it's my first book that got me this reputation. So my first book, I pointed out that a lot of the stuff that physicists nowadays work on in the foundations of physics isn't really science anymore. They've kind of strayed over into the terrain of philosophy and partly even religion.
Yes, but, you know, how do you figure that science and religion sort of have come from the same roots? I mean, is this something that you also, you talk about it in your book, but you also don't want to sort of poo-poo what the rest of science is saying. So how do science and religion have same roots?
I think it's just historically been the case that we have tried to address these really big questions. How did the universe begin? Where do we come from? What are we made of? And there are three options that we have to try to make headway on it. That's religion, physics, and then there's philosophy. And of those three, I think physics has made the biggest progress in the past century. So this is why my book is about physics. I think, how do you tell them apart? So certainly we try to address questions that have the same origin, both with science and with religion. But with science, we look for the evidence. That's something which we don't require of religion.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder, who joins us to talk about her new book, Existential Physics, A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions. And Dr. Hossenfelder, I couldn't agree with you more. We have made tremendous progress, but there are so many questions out there that we still haven't answered. And here's one. You know, about 100 years ago, astronomers taking a peek at distant galaxies noticed that, you know, the galaxies seemed to hold more matter than could be accounted for by visible matter and gas and clouds. And this stuff was dubbed dark matter, the missing mass. And we really haven't figured that out yet, have we?
No, we haven't. That's right. So this is a really old question, but we still don't know what it is. We're not even sure that it is something. It could also be that it's actually Einstein's theory of gravity that isn't quite correct and that it has to be modified. A lot of particle physicists think it's a particle, surprisingly, but we don't know.
Yeah, and they think it's a fast-moving particle that can go through anything. It's got mass. We just haven't been able to see it, and they've set up some tests for it, but no particles have hit these special liquids that they have yet set up. That's my understanding. Do you know if that is true?
That's entirely correct. Those experiments have been done since the mid-1980s or something, and they're different types of detectors, but basically it's a large amount of some material. In some cases it's just water, in other cases it's some kind of difficult solid, and they're very closely monitored for small impacts that could come from those new particles. They haven't found anything. Every once in a while there's been a rumor that they might have seen something, but then it went away. And what's happened over the course of time is that those detectors have become larger, and the detection devices have become more and more sensitive, so they have put stronger bounds on what the masses and interaction rates of those particles could be, but they still haven't found it.
Dr. Hasenfelder, you've been writing about physics for a broad audience, for lay people. That's what we like to think that we do here on Cool Science Radio, kind of turn people on to science in a way that's accessible and understanding. And you've been doing this for such a long time, and I'm wondering what you feel like through, you know, writing books like Existential Physics and then your YouTube series, Science Without the Gobbledygook. How does that further the work that you do as a physicist, and what is the importance of having all of us sort of understanding about these existential questions in physics?
Well, I just think that for me personally, it's been really, really important to learn all this stuff, and I get so much out of it, and I just want to share it with people. And I have to say that I've noticed from myself that I spend a lot of time debunking science news. So if there's a headline saying that, you know, the quantum internet will allow us to send information faster than light, then I'm the one who has to explain, no, it won't. And there are a lot of those headlines. And I do think that's really important, but it's also in the long run, I found it kind of depressing. It gives people the impression that physics is, it only tells us what is not possible. And I think that's a very one-sided picture. So in my new book, I wanted to show the other side of the picture, that physics also, it opens our minds to what is possible. And in many cases, it's actually physics that lets us imagine some new possibility in the first place.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I'm wondering, especially when we talk about quantum physics, and even when we ask physicists, how do you explain quantum physics to the masses? We often get lots of statements like, oh, you know, do you have a week that you can sit around and listen to me? And, you know, there's a lot of confusion even among physicists. But I think that, you know, someone like you coming along and explaining and also debunking this is important. So how, for example, now my grandma Lois, she's been gone since 1982. I miss her. But quantum physics, some would say, could explain why Grandma Lois may still be alive.
Yeah, well, so this was a question that I was asked before, which kind of actually got me into writing this book, because I had to pause there for a moment and think about what it might possibly entail. And I came to the conclusion it's not entirely wrong. I actually think it doesn't really have anything to do with quantum theory. So it's actually an even older theory. It goes back to Einstein's theory of special relativity. And it's got something to do with the problem of making sense of this present moment, which is what Einstein called the problem of now. So the issue is that in Einstein's theory, it's impossible that everyone agrees on which moment is now. And odd as it sounds, every moment, including the moments in the past, could be now for someone. So your past could be somebody else's present. And then you have to ask, why should somebody else's present be any less real than yours? And this is what we call the block universe, in which the past exists the same way as the present.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the past existing. You know, I think since the James Webb Space Telescope went up, and, you know, it was maybe a month ago, a couple weeks ago, that we started to see the first photos from it, taking photos that really are telling us a lot about our past. And that's because we're photographing into, you know, something that is billions of light years away. You start your book with the first chapter, Does the Past Still Exist? How does the James Webb Telescope allow us to answer that question?
Well, the James Webb Telescope, I think it doesn't really, I'm afraid I have to say, it doesn't really say anything about this question in particular. But the James Webb Telescope might very well tell us something about dark matter, which we previously talked about. And that's because if dark matter is made of some kind of particle, then this particle has a gravitational attraction, so it falls into its own gravitational potential, and then the visible matter follows this gravitational pull. So dark matter, if it exists as a particle, is expected to play a very important role in the formation of galaxies. So physicists, astrophysicists have a particular picture of how galaxies should form in the early universe, and makes particular predictions. And now the exciting thing is that with the James Webb Telescope, we can look back in time much further than we previously could. So we can see galaxies that are much younger than we have previously seen. And now we can test some of those theories. Is it right that galaxies form the way that this dark matter hypothesis predicts? And I find this really, really exciting.
Dr. Hassenfelder, when we were talking about dark matter, you mentioned that Einstein's theory of gravity, that we may need to, you know, look at that, and maybe it requires tweaking. He's certainly a central figure in that discussion. He's also a central figure in another discussion, a big question, and that's as it relates to dark energy. In the 1990s, Hubble revealed that distant galaxies aren't just moving away from our home galaxy, but they're moving away at an accelerating rate. And that goes back to our friend Einstein as well. Are we getting any closer to understanding if it's being pushed, if it's being pulled, if what might be at play?
Yeah, that's right. So Einstein introduced a second constant in his theory of general relativity. The one constant is just the strength of gravity, which is also called Newton's gravitational constant. Mm-hmm. But then there's a second constant, that's the cosmological constant, which Einstein introduced because he didn't want the universe to expand. That's what it can do. It can counteract or help the accelerated expansion of the universe. And now in the 1990s, it was found that it looks like the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating, which means that the cosmological constant can't be zero, but it has to have a small positive value. So I think that came as a surprise to many people. So the cosmological constant is back. We have no idea what it is. I'm not really sure if this question makes sense, because you can just interpret it as a constant of nature. It just has some value, and that's that. But it might also be that it really tells us that the universe is filled with some kind of fluid, loosely speaking, and that could change over the course of time, and that could continue to affect the expansion of the universe in a number of ways. So I guess the short answer is no, we still don't really know what it is.
You know, I have to tell you, I just get a kick out of this. He comes up with this spectacular general relativity that indicates, relativity indicates that the universe must either be expanding or contracting. He didn't like that. It didn't make sense to him. So he decided to fudge his theory with this cosmological consultant. I mean, I just got a kick out of thinking that Einstein needs to, you know, throw a little tweak in there. For some reason, I find it humorous. Is that humorous to you?
Well, to some extent, I think I find it really, really fascinating that to some extent his theory was smarter than he was. You know, the theory knew that there could be this additional constant, and it knew that if you put matter into the space-time, then it expands, even though Einstein didn't actually want this. So I think it illustrates just how powerful mathematics is in the description of nature.
Yes, the power of mathematics. And you say in your book, while you're quite into mathematics, it's interesting that here at Cool Science Radio, we get books all the time about people trying to explain math when it's really can be so abstract. And they are trying to draw parallels to all of these things that might be more graspable for those of us who aren't as into math as a physicist. Why do you think math doesn't need to be explained or broken down? Like, you know, like John is talking about Einstein and having to twist it a little bit to fit things into the theory.
Well, I guess it depends on what you're trying to achieve. If you just want to get people a sense of what the explanation is, how it works, then I think you can go with analogies and metaphors. I think there is a certain level of depth beyond which you can't dig, so to speak, without actually writing down the mathematics. But I would say for many purposes, you don't really need those details. So if you can formulate it in words, I think for understanding on some level what's going on, that's sufficient.
Okay. Moving on, I'm wondering about the multiverse. We hear people talk about the multiverse and whether or not copies of us exist out there. What do you say about that?
Yeah, so the multiverse is certainly an idea that's recently become very popular in the foundations of physics, and maybe not so surprisingly, it's also attracted a lot of attention in the general public and also, you know, by Hollywood and science fiction authors and so on and so forth. There are different types of the multiverse, but they all have in common that there are other universes besides our own, and we can't interact with them. So I guess that's a little bit different than it is in Hollywood. I suppose physics kind of has the boring version of the multiverse, where you actually can't travel into those other universes, but that's the way that it is. And some of those other universes could be very, very similar to our own, and they could indeed be so similar that there are copies of you and me, and they live their lives pretty much the same way as we do, except that at some point in the history of mankind, one person makes a different decision, and then everything after this develops completely differently. And now I think that this is kind of a nice idea, and it's certainly inspirational, and that's why people like to think and talk about it, but it isn't supported by anything in science. So it's not that science says it's wrong, but it also can't provide any evidence to support it. And it's what I call an ascientific idea. Science doesn't say anything for it, but it also doesn't say anything against it. So you can believe it if you want to.
Dr. Hassenfelder, somebody once asked, if aliens are here, why haven't they presented themselves to us? And I think it was Michio Kaku who was giving the talk. He answered, I believe it was him. He said, if you're walking in the woods and you see a squirrel, you don't sit down with it and try to teach it advanced calculus. And you know, they may be indifferent to us. And the thing that I thought about then was, are we squirrels looking up into the universe? Is it possible that we're never going to be able to get our arms around some of these questions? Do we have the capability to answer some of these questions?
Well, the obvious answer is that I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I can't tell the future. But I think from my personal experience, when I look at some of those big problems that we currently have in the foundations of physics, like understanding quantum mechanics and dark matter and dark energy, I'm pretty confident that we can solve those problems with the mathematical tool and the understanding that we already have. So I hope I'll see it in my lifetime. But there might be some questions to which we'll never have an answer. And the beginning of the universe might be one of them. I'm personally quite skeptical that this is a nut that we'll ever be able to crack. And there might be a few others. For example, I don't really think we'll ever have a theory of everything. So in some sense, our ability to grasp the universe might be limited, yes.
Yeah, and it's obvious to Lynn and I that you are a very curious person. What one question in physics do you have that you'd like to have answered? Just one question that has not been answered yet.
Well, I would really like to know why we do have an error of time, which is what we call the observation that we only get older but never younger. And we have understood part of this puzzle, but we still don't really know the full story. And this is one of those things that I think about at night if I can't sleep.
It's a big question, that's for sure.
You must have a lot of those. There is a chapter in your book titled, Is Consciousness Computable? And I don't know how it relates to AI, but there's so much discussion around AI and, you know, its limits and how it can never mimic the human brain, and some say it can. And I'm wondering what physicists say about that. I mean, you say that if consciousness emerges from the fundamental laws of physics that we already know, consciousness is indeed computable. How does it relate to artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so I think this chapter, if I remember correctly, is an interview with Roger Penrose, because he's arguing that actually consciousness can't be computable. And in that case, an algorithm like we use for artificial intelligence, machine learning, and so on and so forth, could not actually be conscious. Personally, I don't subscribe to this idea. I think that it's quite plausible that consciousness is something which emerges in very connected networks at some point when they exchange enough information, if they have enough structure. Of course, we don't really understand exactly under which circumstances that will be the case. And I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm not really competent to talk about it. But I don't really see any particular reason why it should not be possible.
Okay, I like that answer. Sabine, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about, you know, sort of the science. You talked before about the science news that you regularly debunk. And it leaves those of us who aren't scientists, who aren't physicists, wondering what science we should believe. Because there is this argument that's you know, we ought to believe in science, not the rest of it, not the gobbledygook. How do we judge as lay people, and how do we educate ourselves on real science?
Yeah, that's a pretty big question. And I don't think that I have any particularly great and new insights. You have to be very careful with the kind of sources that you use. Personally, I also like to rely on experts that you find on social media, people who actually work in the field, because they're often able to give you a very quick assessment of a new paper or a new claim, something that would take you a really long time to figure out if you've never heard of it before. So I think social media is actually good for something in that case.
Well, and also the scientific method is the way it's set up. It's set up for people to challenge, to look at differently, to come right through the front door and say, no, I don't believe that. I believe this. And that sort of thing. So that's sort of the basis of the scientific method. And, you know, it seems to work pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten us pretty far. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Sabine, I'm wondering in your YouTube series and also when you were deciding on what to include in existential physics, how much you take from curious lay people who pose questions to you, knowing that this is one of the things that you do, that you try to bring and distill these topics. Let us know how we can also add to, you know, the topics that you cover.
So I do pay a lot of attention to the comments that people leave on my YouTube channel or on my social media. And actually, when I was selecting the questions that I would include in this book, I was looking at what I previously talked about, what I'd written about, and I was asking what are the topics that that people are most interested in. And what stood out is that it was all those big existential questions. Do we have free will? How was the universe created? Was the universe made for us? Are there copies of us in other universes? And so I decided to collect those into the book. And I quite regularly ask my audience, if they are interested in a particular topic, please post it in the comments. Or if there is something that I've talked about and there would be an obvious follow-up, then I ask them if they want to hear more about it. And I just literally just yesterday recorded a video that was much requested.
Well, if you'd like to see Dr. Sabine Hasenfelder's YouTube series is called Science Without the Gobbledygook, and we are speaking with her today about existential physics. It's her new book. It's A Scientist's Guide to Life's Biggest Questions. Sabine, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's been quite illuminating.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sabine. We were just speaking with Dr. Sabine Hasenfelder about her book, Existential Physics. Now, tens of millions of people who use apps to help track their health, including millions of women who track their menstrual cycles, there's a real risk that reproductive health data could be accessed through these apps, either via cybersecurity breaches, law enforcement subpoenas, or data brokers that sell the data. Joining us to talk about this issue that's been in the news since Roe v. Wade was overturned are two cybersecurity and healthcare executives who joined to talk not politics, real privacy issues behind this issue. Lisbeth Malig is the Information Security and Privacy Officer at Concord Technologies, and Chris Larkin is the Chief Technology Officer also at Concord Technologies. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, we're very pleased to have you with us here this morning. Lisbeth, why don't we start with you? Take us back before Roe v. Wade was overturned, June 24th, 2022. What kinds of health apps and technologies did people use to help them understand when they were fertile or how to get more information about what their options were and those sorts of things?
Well, there are a lot of many different healthcare apps. A lot of them are period tracking apps where you enter your different information. There are temperature checking apps. So I think a lot of the misconception is that once you enter those information, only those information are tracked. The interesting thing is that all those information plus other information are also tracked. For example, your GPS location, your IP addresses, and all those things are also taken along with the information you input in those apps. And those information could be sold to third parties. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah. Thank you, Elizabeth. That's right. You know, we're in kind of this imperfect storm, I would call it, where we have this dramatic rise in the use of social media and these location services, as Elizabeth mentioned. We are out searching on things like on the larger search engines. And now we have new strict laws about reproductive health and reproductive health care and the applications that are going on that. And the scary part about this is it's all evidence. And so certain circumstances. And so that's the thing that, you know, your listeners should really realize is that as we put locations as we chat, a lot of that, no matter how private it is, can be discovered if an agency is investigating a crime. So that's a big word of warning to your listeners.
Yeah, and Chris, I don't know if they still do this, but it used to be that when you used Uber for the very first time and you wanted to and you schedule a car, you would get a message saying, do you want to enable your location, which will bring the driver directly to you? And if you're, of course, in a crowded New York City area, you say, yeah, I would. And they come and they pick you up and all that. But what most people don't know is once you say yes to locations being enabled, then it's that way all the time. And Uber knows where you are all the time. Has Uber ever been subpoenaed for this kind of information?
I actually don't know about Uber. I do know that that Apple and, as we know, Facebook certainly been in the news lately, and others are subpoenaed often. And so that is now it is a go-to practice of law enforcement to find out and investigate a crime. One of the first things that they do is they go to the social media companies. And so that's not even a special circumstance anymore. It is a rather first level, almost lazy way to conduct an investigation. I'm not casting dispersions on law enforcement. It's just a first practice now.
Right. Well, the path of least resistance, right? If it's available, if it's subpoenaable, if that's a word, then why not use it? And, you know, many people may be listening to this now saying, oh, this sounds a little far-fetched. And yet with these apps and bringing us back to something like menstrual cycles, this app Flow, which is the most popular tracking app, has amassed 43 million users. And there's another app, Clue, which has about 12 million monthly active users. That's many millions of users putting their data up there. And as early as 2017 in Mississippi, where they've banned abortions for a long time, they actually subpoenaed this information from phone data and online searches for abortion pills to support charges for second-degree murder against a woman. This, again, is in 2017. So it's happening now. It's been happening. And what do you, Chris and Lizbeth, have in terms of advice for women? Is it just not using these apps altogether? Just pencil it up on a calendar that you have on your wall?
I'll start and then would love to hear from Lizbeth on this as well. You know, the first few pieces of advice that I have is there are statements and even what I'll call events in these apps that are so private and explicit that the one that I was, as I was working through some of this yesterday, I noticed it brought up, would you like to log the termination of this pregnancy in one of the period tracking apps? And that would timestamp And if location services are on, that would provide a location and a timestamp for that particular user. So turn off location services. The other thing that I would do is make sure that when you're chatting online, you're doing so through an encrypted platform. Now, that encrypted platform just means that there's like a tunnel of silence between you and who you're chatting with. And that tunnel of silence essentially is an encrypted message. So others cannot hear it or listen to it. So use an encrypted platform, like a very common one is WhatsApp, for example, that's used significantly on an Apple iPhone. So iMessage is another, has an encrypted capability as well. So there's a few things that you can do to begin to protect yourself. The biggest piece of advice that I can give is just like a spy in a movie, you have to be your own data guardian. Make sure that you know who has your data, what rights do they have, and how explicit you want to be in some of these very, very personal pieces of data. Lizbeth, over to you.
Yeah, so I think one of the studies that I read through is they looked at 10 most common applications, and they found out altogether from the 10 different most common applications, they sold the data to 150 downstream third parties. So that's a lot of other people that have your data. And my advice would be, do not input any data into any app that you are not comfortable publicizing to other people, regardless if it's just normal data, pictures, or your most intimate details. Think of it that way. If you know 150 other people is going to know. So yes, if you want to go back to, putting on the calendar, use a calendar, pencil, paper, thermometer. That's what I would do. And that's what I do. Mm. Especially when you think you juggle between the risks and the consequences in post-RV weight situation. That's what I would do.
Yeah. And the other thing that Lizbeth and I have talked about too is that free isn't always free. So as you pull down an application, make sure that you know what's going to be done with the data that you're putting in it. So these companies have to make money somehow. And many times when the application is free, they're doing that to collect your data. So it's just, again, something else to be aware of.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Chris Larkin and Lizbeth Malig from Concord Technologies. They're both experts in cybersecurity and in the healthcare technology space. I just want to say that statistic again that you presented, Lizbeth. The 10 most common apps, the data from those are sold to as many as 150 downstream third parties. They're taking this data. And we as users of apps, apps are sort of new, in the last, 10, 15 years. And only a few of them, like John was talking about, Uber, for example, will say, when you sign up or, when you're booking, say, an Uber ride, and it will say, do you want this app to use your location? And then you have you have a choice, but only on very few apps, I think, that says only while I'm using this app. And so that is one way of maintaining a small modicum of privacy, I guess. But many of these apps, we don't know where our data goes. We don't know what's being shared. And if we were to read the fine print and go down, do we ever have in our settings the ability to control where our data is shared? Chris?
As you mentioned, being able to being able to shut down the location services. But once that data leaves your phone and is managed in the cloud, you have very little control over it. The biggest point of control you have is whether or not you input the data. Companies also will be good and some of them honest about saying that we will de-identify your data. In other words, we will remove your name, who you are, anything that identifies you from your data, and then still sell your data, or that they will improve their own services with your data. And that's a good step, which is in terms of protecting your privacy. So that way they get to use your data. It's just not associated with you anymore. There are really valid ways to do that. And so good ways and poor ways to de-identify your data. But that's one way and one question that you can ask. I did notice that some of these period tracking apps that I've been looking at, they do ask you and caution you and whether you want to delete the data. So I would choose to delete the data. I do that frequently on applications that I use. So the better apps will ask you to whether you want to delete the data, and especially in the cloud. A word of warning, they also say, by the way, we keep your data for X number of months in case you want to reuse it later. So there's just read the information on the application, please, and make sure that you delete the data whenever you feel nervous. Also, contact the companies and making sure that if you do ask to delete the data, get them to verify that the data was deleted.
So. Yeah. Chris and Lisbeth, we're talking about privacy for healthcare, but let's take a peek at this from 40,000 feet and just think about a broader issue. And this is for either of you. We have these forces at play. One force is we have tech companies that have been designed and built to monetize and leverage data. Two, we have, you know, a budget in our country that has been awarded by Congress to Homeland Security, and they develop and hire firms to build applications so that they can, you know, spy on organizations or people for our security reasons. But we all know that we're all concerned that those are all being used in the appropriate manner. Then you got the dark web that'll sell individuals and other companies eavesdropping products. And then we have the people themselves in this country. Some are distrustful of the government and want more privacy protections. Some like all this stuff. And then meanwhile, China and India and other countries are really raising the bar on human rights and different bad behavior for privacy. So the question I have for either of you, if these forces collide, is can we see ourselves clear of this mess?
Yeah, let me start. And then, Lisbeth, you can chime in. I don't think so. We're becoming more digital, not less digital. We are creating terabytes, petabytes of data every day, not only about ourselves, but about the communities that we interact with, whether it's healthcare, our doctors, our nurses. And so I just don't see less data being collected. I am hopeful that we can provide, much like the European community has, with general legislation that protects our data as citizens of the U.S. One of our problems that we have now is that different states are enacting different data protection and privacy laws, but they're all doing it a little bit different. So as we travel from state to state, we're not entirely sure about how much our data is being protected. So having a federal legislation about privacy is one of the ways that we can begin to solve this and make sure that we're all of our companies are operating in our best interest as much as possible. Lizbeth.
Yes, and I think on the lower level, as a consumer, personally, I think we have to really think about weighing the benefits of what we use and what we do technically, what we put out there, versus what we claim private. Is it worth the risk? Again, is it worth the risk of a little convenient versus the potential of having all our private data being disclosed? I think that is something that we as a society should think about, right? We are so used to nowadays putting all kinds of data out there and not thinking about the consequence.
I'm sure there's somebody. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I'm sure that there's somebody out there that has read through some of these agreements that flash up on your screen when you download a new app. It's all in legalese, but for all the people that I know, everyone just zips down to the bottom and says, yeah, I agree, because they just want to get on with their day. It's hard to understand this stuff. It's hard to assess out if we are giving permission or not giving permission to certain things. I mean, they make it difficult.
They do. I think the longer the agreement, the bigger the risk, personally. So I try to read those too every once in a while. But what I would say is, when in doubt, close hold your data, keep it. And don't provide it. So, but again, the more legal it's become, the bigger the companies also, the more they can afford to have to protect their own interests in managing the data. So the real question is, who's protecting the consumer's data and who's protecting the person's data? We all cannot afford to have our own privacy lawyers. And so, So from that standpoint, again, it gets back to what Lizbeth said, which is, you know, just like spies in a movie, we have to make sure that as we walk into a certain location, we turn off location services. Maybe even we shut down our phone. So just to make sure that we are not tracked or that we're not providing evidence where we don't want evidence.
Yeah, just don't throw your phone in the garbage can and crash it and throw it away.
You know, it's funny. I was reading somewhere in maybe the points that you provided or one of the articles I was reading connected to this that talks about, you know, if you are, for example, someone who lives in a state that doesn't allow abortion, and you travel to another state where abortion is permitted to get an abortion, and then you're in the waiting room and you use your phone, you know, your location is picked up automatically. And so even if you've never used these menstrual cycle tracking apps, for example, that's a way that information can be found, you know, you can be found out. And I'm just wondering, what is the likelihood of that? And does it indeed happen as we speak?
The legal side is that because every day the law changes, it's very fluid right now. And the precedence of what we call vigilante law, where citizens could actually raise issues against another citizen, it could happen. And they could summon such a request for your location-based services records. And there has been speculation that if that is found, they could prosecute the individual. Because of your residence being not allowed abortion.
Yeah.
So there has been discussion in articles. I don't think there has been an actual case, but again, does anybody want to have that risk?
Right.
Yeah, that's right. And Lynn, I will talk to the technical ease with which that data can be arrived at. So it is very easy to pull location services off of a phone, especially within a particular app that tracks it, but that data is kept. We have had circumstances where Apple has actually defied subpoena to break open their phones, but not all companies, especially smaller app companies, have the wherewithal that Apple does. So,
right.
So it does happen, but the smaller the company, the more pressure I think that the federal government or the investigating activity can put on that particular company.
Okay. Have just about 30 seconds left, and I wanted to ask this question. When I use apps, health tracker apps, or even like Strava to track my bike rides or runs or whatever, I'll use them, and then I'll just stop using them. I don't enter the data all the time, only maybe for a month if I'm tracking something in particular. And these menstrual cycle tracking apps, that's something that they can pick up on as well. If you stop tracking your menstrual cycle, then is that signifying that you must be pregnant? And, you know, is this sort of data even used as an assumption that, oh, you must be pregnant, instead of being just like me where you just stop tracking?
Yes, there has been speculation that, yes, it could infer that you got pregnant and then you start tracking again, then you may have had an abortion. So that has been spoken about and has been in discussion. So a lot of muddy situation right now, and it's very fluid. We really are in a post-RV Wade, a lot of things still in discussion, and not all tracking apps are accurate, so.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. Chris Larkin is the Chief Technology Officer, and Lisbeth Malig is the Information Security and Privacy Officer at Concord Technologies. We want to thank you both for joining us this morning in such an important conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.